Accession number 10928, Reel 3.
Duncan Bullman, Reel 3.
I think we were the first troops to penetrate the Gothic line. Of course, the battle went on for 4 or 5 days. It was not a single day. And I suppose in those 5 days we perhaps advanced a mile, mile and a half. The country was mountainous, and German defense was pretty intense.
Did you ever see the casino area?
I was not involved in the casino battle, but I visited the village of Casino about a month after it was captured. And in all of the war, it was the most desolate battlefield that I ever witnessed. Complete destruction, horrifying. I don't think there was much of a tank battle at Casino, but the Germans had put tank turrets on top of pillboxes in the ground, so that as the British tanks and American tanks came along, they had these turrets which rotated just like a tank turret and could pick up their targets. And they themselves were presenting a very small target. I think the Poles played a great part in our victory at Casino. They were very fine fighters, and no doubt they played a major part in that victory.
Did you see the monastery? You know what had happened?
What remained of it, yes. Yes. Of course, it was in a completely dominating position, and for miles in front of it, you couldn't move anywhere without being...
That must have been quite hard going, wasn't it, over that terrain?
Well, militarily, of course, it was very hard going. But in peacetime, when you weren't fighting, the roads in the main would be passable. Militarily, what happened was whenever the valley narrowed and they thought they had a good defensive position, the Germans would blow a big hole in the road so you couldn't get past. And then you had a battle until you could push them back with your weapons, your firepower.
So when you arrived on the plain, would that all have been plain sailing, or did you still find problems?
Well, of course, our brigadier told us we were going to be in Rome, in Vienna, in 3 days. But he was talking nonsense. We thought we'd break out onto the plain, but when we got there, we found that at very close intervals there were canals with steep banks and water running through them. And in fact, the canals were impassable to tanks. So all sorts of means had to be devised. One means would be to have a tank with a bridge on top of it instead of a turret. And this tank would be driven down into the canal so that other tanks could then come along and ride over it, making sure that they kept straight ahead, and get up the bank the other side. But in fact, militarily, it was very difficult to advance more than 200 or 300 yards at a time. Another great handicap to us in the plains were the vineyards. If you're in a vehicle with tracks, to have a lot of vines growing on wires were a terrible problem. One example, if the tank went underneath the wire and the wire came up, it could do very nasty injuries to your head sticking out of the top. But much more commonly, the wires would get tangled up in your tracks. And then, of course, everything got clogged up. So, at the end of the war, we were very glad to get aerial photographs which showed us how the vines ran. And then in this way, we could plan our attack so that we ran along in between these vineyards and didn't get the wires on our tanks. Aerial photographs were most useful.
Yes, I suppose you were using them a lot, weren't you, in
Italy? Right at the end of the war. But for most of the war, of course, we just had maps.
Did you find that you knew the war was ending, you know, towards sort of May, April and May 1945? Did you feel that the war was going to end?
Oh, yes. I mean, at the end of 44, we were very hopeful. We felt sure that the Germans couldn't win now that the Allies had landed in France. And so we got more and more confident. And by the time April came, I think we could say we were enjoying ourselves. It was almost a victory parade.
Were you, made a fuss of by the Italians?
Well, it was rather funny. By that time, every Italian was a partisan. And whenever you spoke to them, they would always tell you what they'd done to win the war. We used to treat them with rather contempt.
Did you?
Hmm.
Why was that?
Well, we didn't think they were very good soldiers in the first place. And secondly, when they said they were partisans, we didn't believe them. On the other hand, we started to notice the Italian girls, who, of course, when they're young, are very beautiful.
Is it rather worrying, though, when you come towards the end of the war? You know, I wonder if you get a special feeling about survival.
Well, you do, because you say to yourself, it would be stupid to get shot now when I'm so near to victorious end of the war. And indeed, as a troop officer, I got most concerned. I didn't want any of my troop to be killed. Not many in the regiment were, but what would happen? You'd get a lone German sniper who would stay behind. Perhaps he was up in a tree, and suddenly he'd shoot and pick somebody off. And this was always very distressing, very distressing.
I believe you mentioned you went to Germany for a while after Austria. Is that right?
In 1946, yes.
Was that very different, going into Germany, the sort of atmosphere?
Well, we were in the American zone, and the first thing we noticed was the different attitudes of the Americans. We rather despised them because the Germans soon had them doing what the Germans wanted, and they could influence the Americans. Very few Americans spoke German, and most of them were rather naive about occupying a country. We had been told, of course, that we should not fraternize with the German civilians, and I took this seriously, and indeed most of my regiment did. But at times we'd be teased by the German girls. They would say, "Oh, can't you give us a kiss?" and this sort of thing. And we had to be rather firm in our resolve not to get on that sort of term with them.
It sounds quite different from Austria.
I think there was a difference. One always felt that the Austrians were a mixture of North and South. They had some of the Teutonic discipline, but at the same time, they were much more relaxed and, you know, laissez-faire. We liked the Austrians much more than we liked the Germans.
Yes. What area of Germany were you in?
I was in Ulm, which is a town in Bavaria.
Was there much damage in Ulm?
Well, there had been a fair bit, but happily the cathedral had not been damaged. The cathedral has the tallest spire in the world. That came through unscathed, but much of the town where the civilians lived had been bombed.
How quickly was that being dealt with, would you say? You know, was there much rebuilding going on while you were there?
I can't honestly remember rebuilding at that time, and I think it had not begun. This would be spring of 46.
I think you told me you ended the war in intelligence. Is that right? That you transferred to the intelligence branch?
That's right. I managed to get a transfer from my tank regiment to intelligence. My purpose was to make use of my German and to remain in Austria. And I spent 3 months in Graz as a G3 intelligence officer.
What were you doing? You know, what can you talk about your work? You know, what?
Well, at that time, we were screening the Austrians and trying to sort out the Nazi Party members. And anyone who was convicted of being a Nazi was put in a prison of war camp. And I remember one incident where an Austrian girl came in and asked if she could please visit her father, who had been an innocent member of the Nazi Party, but now was in prison. So I looked up my book of instructions and it said, "No civilians may visit the prisoners." So I told the girl I was sorry, but I could not give her permission. She went away, and then fortnight later, a bunch of flowers arrived for me in my office, followed by a second visit from this girl, who thanked me for using my influence. She'd been to see my superior officer in Klagenfurt, and he had given her permission to visit her father, which she had done. She was quite sure I had been influential in making him change his mind.
Did you pick up much, you know, intelligence about Nazi Austrians while you...
Well, I was quite honestly more interested in picking up German than picking up Nazis. I don't think I ever had anyone arrested. I did go through all sorts of recorded telephone conversations.
Yes, you were saying about the telephone conversations.
Yes. People would be talking mainly about their social life, you know. A chap would ring a girl up, "Will you like to come out dancing this evening?" And I would be interested because he would talk about den Tanzbein schwingen, you know, a slang phrase for let's go dancing. And so I would note down what it was. But I couldn't see anything in that to make me suspect him of being a Nazi. I was billeted with a retired Austrian officer and his wife. This was very interesting. He'd spent much of his life in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire in Yugoslavia, and he'd done things like building bridges. And I got on very friendly terms with he and his wife. So when I left, I remember they gave me some German books to take back with me to England, which I thought was very nice of them.
You did a spell in Budapest, I think, didn't you?
Right at the end of my army career.
Yes, what date would that have been?
June, July, August 1946. What happened was I'd been abroad for 4.5 years, so I was eligible for LEAP, long service leave. And I came home to England for a month's leave. Well, I knew I had 3 or 4 months left before I was demobilized. So I went straight up to London and called on the War Office at Hobart House. And they said, "Why have you come?" I said, "Well, I've got another 3 or 4 months in the army. I would like to volunteer to spend the months abroad." "Oh, why do you want to do that?" "Well," I said, "because I studied French and German at school and I'd like to practice the language." "Oh," they said, "you speak French and German, do you?" I said, "Well, sort of. So come in here and we'll have you tested." So I went into another room. There was a man and he said, "Ah, sprechen Sie Deutsch?" And I said a very convincing, "Jawohl." And then he said, "Parlez-vous français?" And I said, "Mais oui." So he said, "Oh, good, you do speak languages." So then I went away, and the next week I was posted to Base Depot Royal Armoured Corps, which was very depressing. And then I waited another week, and I was posted to Base Depot Intelligence Corps. Not much better. And then, almost the last day of my leave, I got a notice saying I was going to join the military mission in Budapest, surrounded by the Russians. And I went to Croydon, got in a DC-3, and was flown to Vienna and Budapest.
What was life like in Budapest at that time?
Well, for me it was marvellous. We had Cook's Wagon Lee accommodation for our officers' mess, and the food was splendid. There was a nearby park club with two wonderful pianists, and in the evening we could go and eat there. The meals were very cheap. I think a bottle of champagne cost about 3 and 6 pence. And of course, dancing to these two pianists was marvellous. I never enjoyed dancing so much in all my life. We were a very small community. Let's say there was the British military mission, which numbered some 30, the American military mission, and the French military mission. We were not allowed to travel outside of Budapest without a special permit from the Russians. And within the city, we were told that all our movements would be watched by the Russians. So it was rather a spy situation. In fact, my duty was often to interview Hungarians who were anxious to get to England. And they knew that the best chance of getting to England was they could convince me that they really knew secrets about Russian military service. So I had to listen to all sorts of stories, and it was not at all easy for me to sift what was true and what was false. Some of them did come to England, and I kept contact with them for several years afterwards. I met a very nice Hungarian girl there, and she later came to England and married an Englishman, and she lives in Chelsea, and we're still very good friends.
How were the Hungarians living at that time?
They were plagued with rampant inflation. First month I was there, my army pay as a captain converted into Hungarian currency was worth £1 million. And when I left 3 months later, I was earning $3.5 billion. You never drew any money from the cashier unless you had a car waiting at the door with the engine running. Hungarians were best off if they had something like a gold bracelet, and the family would then give one link of this gold chain to the butcher in order to get meat for a week. But it certainly taught me the dangers of inflation. Horrible.
Would that have been the time of the elections, the post-war elections? Would you have been there in that period when the Hungarians...
Well, it was the time that the communists had taken power. There was a very unpopular man called Rákosi, who was then the number one in Hungary. And there was certainly a secret police there, and I think that the Hungarians were very afraid of them.
What other work did the British team do, you know, apart from the work that you were doing, trying to interview Hungarians?
Well, we were very concerned with commercial angles. Before the war, several British firms, for example, J.P. Coates, the cotton people, had been very active in Hungary, and one or two representatives were there trying to work up trade again. So we had a commercial section. Of course, liaison with the Americans was an important part, keeping in touch with them. And I think militarily, it was really an outpost of our military strength. We didn't, of course, have any weapons there. No tanks.
How about the Russians? Did you meet any Russians yourself?
I can't say I made friends with them, but you would look out of your window and you would see Russian soldiers dancing, you know, in the house opposite. And generally, one got the impression that they were very friendly and didn't at all like being militarily. I did get permission to pay a visit to Austria, and on my journey I was stopped in several places by Russian soldiers, but when they'd seen my papers and found I had a valid pass, they didn't make any difficulty. I would say that I thought them rather likeable on a nodding acquaintance.
And they were getting on well with the Hungarians from what you saw,
yes,
did you say?
Yes. There was certainly no Russian repression. Although, of course, there had been a siege in Budapest, and Russians had the city surrounded for 2 or 3 weeks before they captured it. My Hungarian girlfriend lived through that siege, and it was not a nice time.
Mr. Bullman, thank you very much indeed for telling me so much of your war experience, apart from the repatriation. Thank you.
Been a pleasure, and thank you for being so kind.
Thank you.